This is Music Respawn. I'm Kate Remington with cellist and composer Philip Shepherd, and I am so looking forward to talking with you about your part of the soundtrack for Detroit Become Human. It's so great to have a chance to talk with you.
Thanks so much. It's lovely meeting you, Kate.
Detroit Become Human is it's such an interesting idea for a game because it follows the stories of three androids in our not-too-distant future, Connor, Marcus, and Kara, whose character you wrote the music for. And they make some difficult choices. I mean, they've been programmed to obey orders, but all three of them decide maybe that's not the way to go. And it covers some really interesting themes, what makes us human and freedom versus slavery. And so right off the bat, that must have given you a lot of ideas for what direction you could take the music.
Well, it did, and it fit in sort of rather well with some of my interests and a lot of things that have in the past triggered music for me, which is, I suppose, it's always a quest for me to balance science with soul and to look for meaning in machines and this whole idea of kind of bringing, I don't know, Deus Ex Machina or the other way around. And I found with this project that what I thought was going to be mainly a kind of electronic-based score ended up probably being the most organic thing I've ever written, which is strange, but I think that's something to do with the progress of the particular character that I was scoring, which was this android called Kara. And it's no spoiler, but within the first scenes, she's pretty much thrown into the role of actually having to act as a mother, also having gone sort of rogue or deviant, as it says in the game. So what started out as being me trying to find a way to get her a melody that was based around the idea of kind of little mechanisms and switches and electronica suddenly became much more about what does it mean to actually be a parent. And the whole thing sort of flipped on its head and became somehow really lyrical. And also things that I had been working on that were like little motifs that are electronic, I found myself reverse engineering them and actually putting them into organic orchestral instruments. I mean, notwithstanding, there is still electronica woven through within the whole score, but it's not ever a sort of lead line. It's more sort of bubbling under. So it ended up being this, I suppose, this push and pull between heart and soul and mechanics and programming and code. And the weird thing is, when I write music, I don't actually play the piano. I've always played the cello, and the thing I've been doing for the last 10 years in concerts is this thing called live looping, which is when I record a line and then I play on top of it and then another line on top of that, on top of that. And that's very similar to code, in as much as if you introduce a mistake accidentally within one of the first loops, it comes back over and over again, and the whole thing becomes deviant. And there were lots of parallels I found when I was writing music between programming and actually somehow, I suppose, composing the essence of what this character was.
Yeah, that's fascinating. I had no idea that that was part of the process. And what's so interesting to me about the music that you've written for Kara and her story is that it sounds like there was a kind of a building up. There was one interview that I saw in which you said that you were inspired by the flames of a fireplace in a place you were staying to kind of get that really busy kind of underpinnings of the theme. And then at the same time, you kept reducing and reducing the melody to just these two notes. So it sounds like there was a kind of a duality there too, with the busyness underneath and then the simplicity that gets kind of overlaid on top of it.
Yeah, that's right. I often go away to write. I travel a lot, and I'd locked myself away in one of my favorite places, which is in the middle of nowhere in Montana. My phone doesn't work there, which is great. There's a lot of snow, which is even better. And they like putting fireplaces in bedrooms. I was literally sitting staring at the flames one night, and it was really odd. I heard the music almost completely fully formed, which is always a worry because you think, I must be thinking of someone else's. And I'm quite careful not to listen to a lot of music as a result of that. So I had what we call an ostinato, which is basically this kind of loop pattern. And that really was the flames. And it's this kind of flickering. I'm not going to sing it for you because I can't carry a tune in a bucket with my voice. It's terrible. And then I started writing melodies over the top of it. Now, writing a melody with lots of notes is very easy. Writing a melody with very few notes is incredibly difficult, because when you start, it's a bit like good essay writing. The moment you start to kind of precy it down and start to edit it and take out things that feel superfluous, sometimes you're left with nothing. But I ended up just being left with these two notes, which happened to fit, I suppose, syllabically the name of the character, Kara. And then I just started playing around with it and looping it. And a tune kind of came out fully formed that happened to fit with what I'd heard from the fireplace.
Thank you.
I suppose I took quite a long time to get to that point. But once I'd written that, then all of the other pieces of the music unpacked themselves really from that one kind of seed. And I do think of melodies, and in fact riffs or ostinatos or loops or whatever you want to call them, as being seeds, or more like acorns, or they're like packets of DNA, and they appear to be very simple. But the moment they start working for you, they get legs, as we say in music, and it's a bit like a whole code that will unpack. And I suppose within about a week, I had 20 pieces of music sketched out. 15 of them were terrible, and I could throw those away very easily, but there were five that were distinctly different moods, but still had, I suppose, the through line of this particular melody, and also this little kind of riff, this ostinato pattern, as we call it. And then from that, I started developing out themes and variations from all of them, and that ended up being about 55 pieces of music for the entire score.
It's been so interesting to listen to your part of the soundtrack and hear the progression of Kara's story. And also, she rescues a little girl, Alice, from Alice's abusive father. And as they're on the run, I think having the little girl in the story, of course you want to protect her like Kara does. And there's one moment where they're running across a really, really busy highway. And my heart was in my throat the whole time. And the tension that you created in that cue while using the theme and then the ostinato too is just incredible. I mean, it really ramps up the tension.
I would love to take credit for that, but I have to really hand it to the fact that the music editors, Mary Lockwood and Aurelien Bergère, are geniuses. The people working at Quantic Dream were able to take the bare bones. We call them the stems in music. I'm sure a lot of your listeners know this, but all of the different tracks that you lay on top of each other. It's the first time I've ever given them to anybody to be able to rebuild things with. And they did. And also, actually, both Nima and John, the other composers, also played around with them too. So that was one of those cues that was really quite collaborative. And I really can't claim credit for the tension in that scene. And it is terrifying. I went to the studio to watch them putting it together in Paris. And I was so caught up in the scene that I didn't realize it was my music.
Wow.
Which is a good sign, because I'm one of those terrible people who will go and see a movie and I'm just sitting there working out how the music's been recorded, and I find it very hard to escape. But in that, my heart was in my mouth watching that scene. And they said, "What did you think of the music?" I said, I think it was great. Who wrote it?" And they said, "Well, you did." I said, "Oh, did I? Oh, okay."
Thank you.
But you know, that's a sign when you do have a tune that works, it will write itself. And this happens with movies too. Sometimes I'll write a score, normally under a very, very short time constraint. And I know the same goes for the other composers who worked on Detroit as well, that it's not unusual to have to write and record and mix an entire movie score in 2 weeks. And I've done that on numerous movies where you have to start from pencil on the paper through to delivering the whole thing, having gone through an orchestral recording session within days. With this, we had a year. So I was actually able to write a huge amount of music and to be able to remove things that didn't feel like they were on message, that didn't feel they were quite right. But consequently, I actually wrote 3 albums of my own alongside this, because music that I suddenly felt didn't fit in the game became something else and ended up being other tracks altogether. It was an extraordinarily productive time, and the luxury of time makes it actually very difficult, because you change your mind many, many times. So we went through, I think, 8 versions of Kara's theme until we settled on the right one. And David Cage won't mind me saying that it was actually the first theme I played in the first place, of course. But having gone through the progression of them writing lots of other tunes for her and coming back to the first one, it made me realize that actually the first simplest, quickest idea was the right one. But it almost needed to go through the process of being flame-thrown, as we'd say, to make sure it was right.
Well, and that's a thing that a lot of studios go through too, because AAA games especially have development cycles that take years and years. And a lot of times what you thought was going to work initially in the design doc that you wrote the very first time turns out not to work several years later because things have changed. And did you find that as the game went along, you were making choices to reflect the changes that the studio was making too?
No, I was trying not to, actually. And the great thing about working with Quantic Dream was that once I had gained their... trust is the wrong word. Once I gained their faith, they really let me write what I wanted. And in fact, when I first got the commission, it was very strange. It was one of those situations when a few weeks before I'd written down in a journal, I'd love to write a major computer game soundtrack. I've done 60 screen projects, movies and theatre projects, and I've never done a game. Although I'd like to do, maybe a small game to start with. And then 3 weeks later, I had a phone call out of the blue saying, "Oh, would you like to score this game?" So yeah, that would be great. Not quite realizing the juggernaut that was this project. And but the wonderful thing about it was that obviously it being a different art form, really, from what I'm used to. I rang him and said, "Well, what style do you want me to write it in? What's the character? Who am I going to be? What do I need to immerse myself in?" And David Cage just said, "Well, we just want it to sound like you." Which is, that's one of the first times that's ever happened. And that's so refreshing. It wasn't, "Oh, it needs to sound like, Hans Zimmer or, Philip Glass or Lorne Balfe or whatever." They weren't asking me to listen or to try and sound like anything else. He was very keen that it sounded like the catalogue of work that he had already heard from me. Now, what's difficult is when someone says, "We want to write as you," you think, "What do I sound like? I don't know." So, it almost provoked a kind of crisis of, "Oh no, I have to write about myself now," which is very unhealthy. So I think actually having a year to write it was great, because I went through many sort of phases and stages, and then the fact is I kind of came back around the whole way to what I'd started with. And it became very strangely emotional. It's very odd standing in front of a full-size symphony orchestra and conducting something you've written a year ago when you don't actually remember writing it, and thinking, "Actually, this is okay. This might be all right." Thank you.
There are a lot of games, especially AAA games, that have so many hours of gameplay that have to be covered with music. Yeah. And they bring in multiple composers, but all of the people that I've talked with about this process say that they work out of a catalog of a ready-made sound or a ready-made system of music, so that the music sounds pretty seamless, and you really can't tell, unless you're listening closely, who wrote what. But it sounds like Quantic Dream, in this case, wanted everybody to come up with a unique sound for each one of the characters. And yeah. So what I'm wondering is, Mary Lockwood, the music supervisor, how did she keep everybody on track so that it didn't sound like completely different, like three different games?
Well, this is the crazy thing is, when we first started writing, all of us were convinced that we'd probably go and spend some time hanging out in Paris, improvising together or coming up with some new themes. But we found that when we'd each written, I suppose, our little sort of our short sketches initially for the characters, that I think Mary had found that we were identifying, if you like, a palette of colour that was different for each character. And she wanted, I think, to kind of keep those almost isolated from one another and siloed off. So we suddenly flipped and did the opposite, which was we didn't correspond actually about what we were writing, but more made sure that everyone was keeping in step with the process. So we were roughly at the same stage in terms of getting rough sketches delivered, you know, even down to the extent of, you know, when are you having your music copied up and printed and, you know, who's in the studio which week. Just so it was a totally parallel track process, but we, for a long time, all of us were sort of blind to what the others were doing. It was obviously all sitting on a server that we could all access, but I think all of us were feeling, well, if it's going well, we should probably pursue our own tracks. Much like the characters doing the game. Because if you think about it, the characters themselves, you know, when they're first presented, are very much within their own worlds, their own minds and their own actions. And I think the great thing was it meant that we could develop those up in their own sort of partitions to the point when they were strong enough voices and motifs, so that when they do need or did need to layer up, then they can, because they're identifiably different. And being very basic about it, John's is sort of, I suppose, this hybrid epic symphonic approach. Nima's is much more experimental, electronica, but still organic. And mine tends to be string-based with electronics within. So everyone's got a very identifiable sort of textural tonal palette. But then, funny enough, the themes themselves started to have common features to them, in more in terms of, I suppose, their brevity and the way that they address the characters, voice patterns and all those kind of things. So the process really changed almost instantaneously from what we thought we were going to do to what we ended up doing. And there's one thing about that that I think is particularly fascinating for me, having not done a game before. When I write a movie, whether it's a documentary or a drama, I have to portray everybody on screen with a motif. So, you know, whether it's a female character or whether it's a male character, whether they're melancholic, whether they're old or you're young. I'm also often having to describe the soundscape, the landscape where things are happening. And sometimes I'm just having to be a frame around a canvas onto which something's projected. So you're covering lots of roles. In this, actually, my main focus was just to write Kara from the inside of her head out. Nothing else. I've never had to do that before. And it meant that I became fiercely loyal to her. And so I remember when my son was playing the game for me, because I'm terrible with the PS4 controls, and she died, I got really quite annoyed. It's like, no, you can't kill her. She's my character. But you know, I realized that in a weird kind of way, I sort of fell in love with the character, which is very strange. And I think the only people I've ever heard where that's happened with before are probably novelists, where, you know, you're writing for a character who you're so ingrained into the way they're thinking, and you're so loyal to them, and you so want to propel them through the narrative, that when they fall out of the narrative, it's kind of catastrophic. But I wasn't having to be anything else. I wasn't having to represent a polar opposite to her.
Well, I think a lot of that is due to the actress who plays Kara, Valerie Curry.
Oh, she's amazing.
She just did an amazing job. I mean, and all the way through, I more often than not forgot that Kara was an android because the character's modeled so well, and it's only when they get hurt that you see their blue blood and you realize that they're not human. So how much did Valerie's performance influence the music that you wrote?
Oh, well, hugely. And the I was very lucky because I was working from the rushes that were shot in the mocap studio. So I asked that as well as having the, I suppose, the basic graphics, I asked to work also with actually the straight film of her, you know, with all the bubbles attached to her face and the catsuit and everything. So that the whole time I was working from her live performance. I mean, what's incredible is actually how much was captured on screen in the end. It's remarkable. But what was fascinating about the way that she acts, and I was noticing this really watching the footage, and I watched hours and hours of it to kind of get her, because really I was writing her and she was portraying Kara. We weren't both going to cut, if that makes sense. It's a strange thing. So it's more like working, when I've written ballet scores, it's more like trying to actually get inside the character of the dancer who's then going to take that and portray it, build it into a character, if that makes sense. Rather than you both try to be a character, you might end up with something different. So it's a very strange thing to say, but I was very much writing towards her. And what she has great command of is silence, and she knows when not to do anything. And that's also the mark of an extremely good actor, when they know how to do nothing very loudly and very, very strongly. And the only other actress I've ever seen do it that I've worked with live was Juliette Binoche, who has the same quality of being able to actually just stop, do nothing brilliantly. And actually, it's also the mark of a really good musician, is someone who can play silence very loudly and very confidently and almost being full circle and not filling a melody with too many notes, of actually having, you know, I'm going to do something very small extremely well. And that's really, I think, what Valerie has in spades. You know, in fact, all of the lead actors do. I've come to know Brian very well, who plays Connor, who's amazing, and I've seen him act live, and he's phenomenal. And what's captured on screen is absolutely what he can do. It's remarkable. I've never seen mocap that well used as a translation of a human to another human or humanoid. Obviously, with people like Andy Serkis transmuting into something else, that's different. But when you're taking a human form and turning it into a human form, I didn't feel we hit the uncanny valley really at any point, which is remarkable.
Yeah, they're so believable. They almost like jump out of the screen. And I was also feeling very protective of Kara and Alice. And there's, it's just so stressful, their journey, meeting people that clearly want to hurt them or kill them. And yet there's this one really wonderful moment where they're taking a break. They've found an abandoned amusement park, and a group of androids shows up, and you're so conditioned to expecting this to turn into a dangerous situation that, you know, you're on your guard. But all they want to do is fire up the carousel for Alice so that she can have like one little happy moment. And I love that moment. And I love how in that cue, the carousel, you've used some kind of iconic carousel sounds, but it like doesn't go over the top.
And you'll notice that the carousel, the barrel organ, is playing the flame music.
Yeah.
And the tune over the top is Kara's tune. And I was able to, but I wanted to write it in the style of Tchaikovsky. I wanted to write it as if it was a ball scene, you know, like a kind of a valse in something like Swan Lake.
Thank you.
And of course, it's really the first time that Alice is a little girl and she's actually happy. And I agree with you. I've got three girls and a boy, but the worst scene for me is when they're outside and it's raining and she's wet and she's cold and you think, no, and it's just, how strange to have a computer game where that's your major fear rather than, you know, than being shot at. I mean, it's kind of wonderful, really, you know, and that's why I think people get psychologically invested, because actually your instincts are to care for somebody else. And if only we could have more games that are about empathy, then so much the better. And it really, I don't know about you, but when I was watching the coverage before people really knew what the game was about, and obviously we released what we call the Dark Knight scene, which is not as in Batman, but a Dark Knight with a N-I-G-H-T, where Alice obviously gets, you know, comes to an unfortunate end if one takes the wrong decision, the wrong branch. And it caused a huge scandal. But actually the point was, no, it's not pro-domestic violence, it's against domestic violence, and it's going to educate. You know, that's the thing, is actually anyone I've heard who's played it actually in context has come away feeling, I want to do everything I can to protect this character. It's not, you know, it's this whole bogus argument about, you know, if one sees violence, you're going to copy it. I it's just not true. Whereas if you feel empathy, you're going to do something about it. And I've just seen people getting invested in it. So that's in a way why that theme became so sort of charged, is it also had to sort of hammer home the fact that, no, you're not seeing what you think you're seeing. You know? But we couldn't say that.
Of course. And each one of the characters, they have something. They come to a real psychological crossroads with their programming. And in the context of the game, it makes complete sense that, of course, Kara would want to protect Alice and get her away from her abusive father. So that really gets the story going. And so, yeah. As you mentioned, in the context of the game, and that's what I felt too, it's not all that extreme.
And one of the crazy things is I had some good basis for research into all of this. One of my very dear friend of mine who died a couple of years ago was called Marvin Minsky, and Marvin was the godfather of artificial intelligence. He was the man who invented the whole concept of it. He was 88, 89 when he died, and he was the person who designed HAL for Kubrick for 2001. He taught Arthur C. Clarke and taught Richard Feynman, the great physicist, and was one of the great experts in haptics and robotics. But he spent most of his life philosophically ruminating about, I suppose, what's the moral consequence of a machine becoming sentient? And I'm not going to tell you how, but I've snuck him into the game in a very large way. So there's a bit of an Easter egg for people to uncover there. With the approval of Gloria, his lovely widow, what's nice is that Marvin is in the game pretty strongly. That's a tease, isn't it?
Good, I have to go back and replay it now.
Yep. Oh, yeah.
A while back, you designed a game called Compose Yourself for kids to learn how to compose music. And what I thought was so fascinating about it is that it grew out of a need that you had to write music really quickly. And there are all these cards, and kids can put them together and compose a piece of music. And I'm wondering if that helped you write all of the music that you needed to write for this too.
It didn't practically help me for this. It was basically that game was based on a system that actually Mozart and Bach would have used, which is to take a measure of music and look at it forwards, backwards, upside down, and upside down and backwards, and create variations out of all of that. Now the trouble is there are only 12 notes in the world, and so there's a finite, it would appear there's a finite number of melodies that you can make, but they really aren't. And with that game, it was very much a proof of concept of saying, well, look, I can give you a deck of 50 or 60 cards, whatever it is, and from that you can have 3 billion unique melodies just in that one in your pocket. So at no point can you turn around and say, well, I can't think of a tune. You can just drop them on the table and there's a melody there. And I wrote a couple of cues for a movie using the system before I'd actually taken it to a toy and game company. And the director had called me and said, you know, these two cues you've delivered overnight, these two pieces of music, yeah, we need to talk about them. I said, oh, yeah, sorry. And he said, no, they're so much better than your normal music. thank you. Great. I do gamify the process of writing music hugely. So, I'm a great believer in, it's not my concept, it's someone much smarter than me, but in this concept of drafting ugly and editing beautifully. So for every one piece of music I write, and I write a lot of music, I've probably discarded 49 other bits. Now, they could just be fragments. They could just be, you know, notes in a row. It doesn't matter, the scrap of paper. But I will every day, a bit like Hemingway used to do, you just sit down and you bang out 1,000 words before you have your first mug of coffee. In his case, a cigarette and a shotgun. But, I'm a great believer in just sitting and writing and being in the process of writing. And from that, you can generate music very fast, because it's down then to a case of, well, what gives me goosebumps? If it doesn't give me goosebumps, I can feed the fire with it. That's fine. It's not personal. And this is another thing about working for a very long time on a project. If a director turns around to you and says, I don't like what you've written, they're not saying I don't like you. And you have to be able to stand alongside them and say, yes, I agree with you. I think we can do much better than this. But it's not this kind of personal slight. And that's a really big step for anyone creative to get to, because it's all to do with your self, sense of self and your sort of ego. And in this process, I had to get rid of a lot of music that I thought was right, until we got down to the music that was actually really right. And it wasn't necessarily the path that any of us started on, like you alluded to, in fact. But you can then end up and say, well, I think this then works, but it doesn't make you as a writer good. It just means that sometimes the music itself becomes strong and becomes, I suppose, it gets its own identity. It's weird. It's almost this thing of, it's a bit like I was saying when I was conducting in the studio. I almost don't remember writing it, because I think once I'd done the bit of getting the melody written and the harmonies and things, the music just unfolded. It just unfolded and it unpacked itself. There's this term in music called audiation, where you just kind of hallucinate where it'll go next. And you just, it's a bit like Paul Klee said, you know, drawing is just taking a line for a walk. Well, writing music is just doing exactly the same thing. You just take that line for a walk until it goes where it feels like it needs to go. And it's as simple as that.
That's so cool. There's a video that I watched on your site. You're at a conference and just kind of on the spot, you composed a tango with nothing more than the last four numbers of a woman in the audience, her phone number. And
oh, yeah.
It was astonishing to me that you could make a piece with so little to go on for inspiration. And then also that I could see you like working it out in your head. And so does composing always come that easily for you?
It does now, because that's a form of gamification, because you can align numbers with notes. And in that particular case, there were 4,000 people in the audience. But for some reason, I was about to play something else, by the way. And for some reason, my eye drifted to the person who was texting and had absolutely no contact with the stage at all. And I thought, well, this this could be fun. So I grabbed a microphone and I went down, and I was literally in front of her before she noticed that the idiot on the stage with the cello wasn't there anymore. And she was completely flummoxed. It was kind of fun. You can also do a sleight of hand with that, which is, yes, I took the numbers of her phone number, but I can then apply any set of rules that I want to them. It's a bit like magician friends of mine who say, well, I want you to pick a card. Once you pick that card, then they decide what the rule set is. So once she gave me those numbers, I think in that case, I thought, okay, I think we're in D minor. Yes, I think so. But it's like I was saying before, you draft ugly and you edit it beautifully. So you try and whittle it down, but also you make it look like it's really going to go wrong. Because if you do that, it's a bit like a tightrope act. The guy's not going to fall off the tightrope. But if you believe he might, it's much more interesting. So I do have this thing of saying to an audience, you know, sometimes I'll take their addresses or I'll take their names or the patterns that they work, or sometimes get them to shout out note names or whatever. But the insurance policy is I can say to them, look, if this is crappy, it's your fault because you wrote it. Which then makes you very free to hopefully do okay after.
Well, also then, you know, they're kind of rooting for you too.
Yes. Oh, they're fully invested. No, that's the great thing is that if there's no jeopardy, then, you know, it won't work. You can actually do the same thing with an orchestra in a studio. You can kind of get their buy-in, and it's a really, there's all sorts of psychological tricks that you can do with this. But the last thing you must do is actually present yourself on stage as if you know exactly what's going to happen. And I have the same thing, even if I'm in Abbey Road with an orchestra, I'll use similar techniques, which is, and in fact I did on this project, and please don't tell the orchestra I did this, but they played Cara's theme through at 10 o'clock in the morning on our first recording session, and it sounded amazing. And I could see Mary and Aurelian and the rest of the team sort of bouncing up and down at the control room, and I'd said to them, under no circumstances can the orchestra hear your reaction when they first play. And I said, wait, what's the problem? I said, no, just trust me. So they played it through and it sounded amazing. And I stood there in front of them. I folded my arms as if I was listening to someone talking to me from the control room, slowly nodded my head and said, I think we'd better do that again. Now, it was amazing their playing. But what happens? Everyone sat up and it got twice as good because everyone in the orchestra is thinking, oh, he noticed. He realised maybe he knows. I didn't know. I thought it sounded great. So that's a tip for any composers out there. And you're not saying anything bad. You're just saying, I think we'd better do that again. I've done the same with logo designers. I've done the same with the website designers. Saying, I think you can do that. I think you could do that again. And you're not saying anything. You're just saying, yeah, I think you have more.
Yeah. You worked with the English Session Orchestra.
Yeah.
Courtney, you've worked with them before, right?
A lot. Yeah, they're great. They're kind of my home orchestra. They're amazing. And that orchestra, two-thirds, maybe three-quarters of the people in that room are people I've grown up with playing chamber music. A couple of them are former pupils of mine, which is kind of crazy when things kind of come full circle in that way. What was great is at the end of the last session, when everyone normally runs to get the last tube train home, it just turned into a party. And I mean, I think we were there till 2 o'clock in the morning. It was lovely. It was a nice way to sort of, you know, wrap the project up. But the orchestra got sort of very invested in the process. I think because also the team that had come from Paris were clearly very taken with the energy that the players were bringing, was very committed. They were just there to do a really good job, which was fantastic. And I couldn't have asked for better players.
Thank you.
Now, bear in mind, as a cellist, I've played with lots of these people, and there's something great about standing in front of people and then playing and coming to the end of it and you saying to them, I'm glad I didn't have to play that because it's really difficult. And that's the point when you employ people who are better than you. And I certainly did in this case. And that was, you know, that was, it was, yeah. It's lovely conducting and feeling that you're getting goosebumps off the orchestra, not because of what you've written, but because of the energy that they're putting into it. And you can't really plan for that. You can kind of create it, but at the same time, that particular group of players are pretty damn stunning.
I love how you gave them these really wonderful moments to shine. And, you know, you kind of stacked the deck too with recording at Abbey Road. And you've mentioned that that's your favorite studio. And, you know, besides the obvious history of it, what's really special about it for you?
It's strange. It's the same for all the musicians I work with. I mean, I've been recording in there for the past 25 years, in fact longer, gosh, I'm older, and still every time I go in there a lot, I'm in there every 2 months, every time I walk in I get head to toe goosebumps. And I think it's not just the obvious history. I mean, yes, we're using the same microphones as the Beatles, that's pretty damn cool. You know, you can go and play the piano in the corner, that's the Lady Madonna piano. Yeah, that's something. You know, my cello teacher was the lead cellist on Revolution 9. That's kind of nice. But more that actually go back way, way further. It's where Edward Elgar conducted Yehudi Menuhin in the first recording of the Elgar Violin Concerto when Menuhin was 14 years old. And then you know, the person who the reason I played the cello is I heard a cellist called Jacqueline Dupre.
Oh, of course, yeah.
Right. Well, I heard her on the radio when I was 3 and I was like, I'm doing that. And my mum was like, what? And I said, what's that? I'm doing that. And I got to know her when I was a kid. You know, I started playing when I was 3 as a result, and I got to know her very well. And it turned out one of my teachers was, you know, the cellist in the orchestra that did the Elgar recording in that studio. It's just for me as a Londoner and as a musician, everything hubs into that place. And, you know, I'm someone who lives, like a lot of film composers, between genres, but there's only two types of music. There's great music and there's everything else. And I don't care whether you call it classical or whether you call it rock music. And the great thing with game music and with movie music is it's become a new form of music where electronica is perfectly acceptable and perfectly musically justifiable, as is a symphony orchestra. And a 14-year-old is way more attuned to hearing symphonic sounds than than when I was 14.
Yeah.
And it converges in Abbey Road. And, you know, my engineer did Star Wars. I mean, I can literally get the best people in the world. I mean, why wouldn't you? Yeah. And it's also not the place. It's also not the time or the place to scrimp and save and try and be over economical. I'm a great believer when you do a big project that's very important to blow the entire budget on the studio and the players. And why not? I mean, you know.
Well, and it shows too. You know, it's like having the very best champagne.
I think all of us did that with our, you know, I think Nemo and John were probably the same. So, you know what? I think we'd better throw as many players in as nice studios as possible at this as we possibly can, you know, because it feels like this game's going to be around for a while. And, you know, one doesn't leave much behind, but the odd marks in the dirt, you know, sometimes that'll be a movie soundtrack. It might be a game soundtrack. It's going to stick around sometimes longer than any of us will, which is weird. So that's the point when I feel like you have to invest your heart and soul into it, you know. And Abbey Road's part of that for me. I'm fiercely loyal to that studio, and it means a huge amount to me as a place. And it's, do you know what the strange thing is? It's very unintimidating. The people who work there make you feel as if you know what you're talking about, and people don't pull rank. And they stay there for years as a result, which is amazing. I did have one strange situation. I was conducting in the Studio 2, which is the Beatles studio. And this was a few years ago. And I was halfway through this piece of music. It was quite complicated. And I was, you know, was in for some reason, I've written it in a very complicated time signature, and I don't claim to be a conductor, but I do conduct my own music. And I was aware there was someone standing behind me, which is terribly rude in a recording session because, you know, you've got to be quiet. And I finished the cue and I turned around, it was Sir George Martin standing there. I was like, oh my God. Okay. And my complex of sort of being, you know, an outsider, an imposter complex, was turned up to 11 by this point. And he said, oh, no, do carry on. It's really quite lovely. And I thought, well, if he doesn't know it's rubbish, maybe it's okay. Maybe I will do this. And in fact, when we went in to record Cara's themes, I bumped into Giles Martin, who's his son, and I told him that story. He said, oh, that's so Dad. So, I felt we were blessed on this project with that a little bit.
Well, we also got to hear a lot of your cello playing, and I just, yeah. It's so fascinating to watch you play because you just like use the whole cello, you know, like those Italian recipes that use the whole pig.
Nose to tail.
You know, use a percussion instrument and use the bow in some really creative ways. And I would love to know a little bit about your cello. I mean, how old is it? Have you had it a long time?
So my cello I call it my modern cello because it was made in 1750. So in England, that's relatively new. I can be really rude about America here, can't I? I love taking my cello to America and saying this cello is older than your country. But the cello that I used for a long time was actually made in 1692. And that was a Stradivarius. But it was one that I was loaned for a long time. But it was beautiful, but it just had sort of one sound, which was like melted chocolate. Mm. My own cello, this English cello from 1750, can sound like anything. And I've because it's like a blank sheet. It's like someone giving you a decent pencil and a blank sheet of paper. And I love it. And I'll never get a different cello. This is mine for life. It's not a particularly famous instrument, but it works as well in a rock band or in EDM music as it does for Baroque music. And for me, it feels like it's my voice. If I could sing, I'd like to sound like that. So, and the reason I use the entire cello, the kind of the as you say, the Italian style of nose to tail cello, is I can't play anything else, to be quite honest with you. I mean, I started learning the cello when I was 3 years old, and I desperately tried to learn the piano, which is my favorite instrument, and failed spectacularly badly at being able to play it. So I've had to learn to do everything on that particular instrument, and whether it's percussion or whether it's playing it as a guitar or whether it's whatever, detuning it and making it sound like, you know, the ninth circle of hell. That's what I use it for. And the good thing is it's the world's greatest synthesizer. A cello can make any noise. It's like the human voice. You can push it to anything. So I'm so glad I chose that instrument. I'm so glad I heard Jacqueline Dupre on the radio. Sounds like a cliche, but it's absolutely true. You know, it's the only reason I write music is because of that. You know,
that's amazing. And you do push your cello. I mean, there's a cue confrontation. I felt sorry for it because it sounded like you were really torturing it.
I did. And I there was a lot of dust at the end of that. And some of it was sawdust. There were 65 cellos on that track, all of them, as well as the orchestra. So 65 of me overdubbed one after another, which is kind of crazy. Yeah, I do this thing of multiply stacking the cello into an orchestra, which is weirdly enough how I got this game in the first place, because David had heard a track that I'd done, that I'd written with David Bowie years ago, and he had worked with David on a previous game. And in that track, it was this song called Everyone Says Hi, and I'd put 44 cellos on it, which were, I didn't tell Bowie, but they were all me, recorded in the home studio overnight with a lot of coffee. And so that kind of became my thing, you know, that kind of sound. And I'm a great believer in a wall of sound, and if you've got a wall of sound, then use it, especially if it feels different from what else is there. But yeah, that particular cue, the confrontation, there's some nasty noises in that when you break it down, really nasty.
Well, so has this whet your appetite to write more music for games?
Oh, I'm desperate to. I love doing it so much, and the reason I enjoyed it is I found it difficult. And as with anything that's difficult, a bit like learning how to run, when you get good results at the end, it's the best feeling in the world. And I'm just, yeah, I count me in, you know, I want to do more of this. I love it. As I say, I've started with something small. Yeah, I don't know if anyone will notice, but I'm fascinated with the idea of doing more. I really would love to.
I would love to hear what you do next. And are there any projects that you can talk about? You mentioned that a side effect of writing all this music was some albums. Are those out now?
So there's an album coming out in the middle of June. We're just looking at the release date now, called Full From Earth, which is, I'll tell you a secret, some of it is tracks that were developed through this process, but then became other things. And then we're going to bring out a remix of that. So I've got people from Black Lab and Left Field and some other quite well-known bands remixing those tracks and putting vocals on them too. So I'm going to bring out firstly the orchestral version of the album, then a second album. And then there's a third album coming out called Great Minds, which is about people like Marvin Minsky and Frank Lloyd Wright and, yeah, some other sort of scientist friends of mine. So, yeah, there's some stuff coming out. But Full From Earth is the first album that's coming out, hopefully very soon. I've been mastering it today, so it's I'm ready to press go on it. That's going to be the next thing out.
Oh, that's really exciting. Well, how can people get in touch? How can people find you on social media and your website?
Well, it's very easy because everything's under the same name, except I have a name that can be misspelt very easily. So my website is philipshepherd.com, and Philip is with one L, and Shepherd is spelt the wrong way. It's Shepard. So it's philipshepherd.com. And then I'm on Twitter under that name, under Instagram on that name. I don't have Snapchat because my kids won't let me, because it's embarrassing, apparently. I don't know what else I'm on, but there's YouTube channels, all that kind of stuff. But it's all under that. And honestly, if people like my stuff, I often will send them free albums and things. So I just like people getting in touch. And if someone's taken the trouble to seek me out, I'll often, you know, I've got a mailing list where people get free albums and things. And I just want to get the music out there, to be honest with you, because I love writing. And when people react, it's the best thing in the world.
Yeah, well, just wait, because the game music audience is unbelievably passionate. So you'll hear from lots and lots of people.
Wow.
Well, Philip, it's been so much fun talking with you, and I really appreciate you taking the time. So thank you so much.
Oh, it's my pleasure, Kate. Thank you so much. And it's nice to meet your audience. So stay in touch.